That was the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time. Reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world. That was the year. On the heels of announcement by the Reparations Commission and the French pressure, and under British protest, that Germany had fallen short on delivery of lumber, telegraph poles, and coal, there comes to the ears of residents of the city of Essen the terrifying sound of resounding martial tread of thousands of military boots on the early morning of January 11. The French-Belgian occupation of Germany's rich manufacturing district, the Ruhr Valley, has begun. The following day, the Berlin government issues a protest, to no avail. On February 11, the Premier of France notifies the German charge d'affaires.
As a result of orders given by the German government to its employees in the Ruhr Basin, and of trouble of all sorts that the German government tries to incite, the Belgian and French governments have decided to no longer permit, after February 12, the exportation to an occupied Germany of metallurgical and other products manufactured in the territories occupied. Raymond Poincaré.
A few nights later, February 16, outside the Kaiserhof Hotel, heavily guarded headquarters of the French Engineering Commission.
Is it properly set?
Yeah. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Then run.
No lives were lost. Little damage was done, and the bomb setters were never caught.
The next day, February 17.
Yeah, Your Excellency. The two parches were sunk today. Yeah. Two 1,000-ton barges. Yeah, the Rhine-Erne Canal is blocked to all traffic. Yeah.
Ach, Gott!
You're under arrest.
On what charge? I have done nothing.
You are but now speaking to your pig of a superior in Berlin, monsieur. We have been listening to your conversation. You are under arrest on charges of sabotage.
Throughout the year, while diplomats wrote notes, exchanged ultimatums, residents of the Ruhr Valley lived in mortal terror of cracked heads, beaten bodies, indeed their very lives. Families were separated, workmen left their homes, never to be seen again. As a direct result of the Ruhr occupation, Germany's financial structure collapsed, until in December of 1923, one gold mark was worth 1 billion paper marks. Thus, 5 years after the armistice, another aftermath of the war to end all wars, the war to make the world safe, for democracy.
1923. That was the year.
London, April 10. In the British House of Commons.
On the motion that the House do now go into Committee of Supply on Civil Service Estimates. For the motion, 138. Against the motion, 145.
Thus did the ministry of Prime Minister Andrew Bonar Law suffer its fifth defeat in 5 by-elections within 6 months. The parliamentary crisis came about as a result of fundamental differences between the government and the Labour Party, notably grievances of ex-servicemen and hindrances to British trade because of the French occupation of the Ruhr. 2 days later, Bonar Law's ministry retrieved its defeat. But the strenuous times of war and post-war had had a telling effect upon the health of the Canadian-born Scottish statesman. And following his trip to recuperate His physicians issued the statement from 10 Downing Street.
In spite of his rest, the Prime Minister's voice is still unsatisfactory. We are unable to promise improvement within a reasonable time. The state of the Prime Minister's general health is not good.
On the same day, Whitsunday, May 20, there was issued from the Royal Pavilion at Aldershot a statement.
The King has received the Right Honorable A. Bonelaw's communication with deepest regret and has graciously accepted his resignation.
Stanley Baldwin became the new Prime Minister, and on October 30, Great Britain's wartime Chancellor of the Exchequer, Andrew Bonelaw, passed away quietly in his London home.
1923, that was the year.
In compliance with its pledges, the new administration, which came into power in March 1921, definitely and decisively put aside all thought of the United States entering the League of Nations. It does not propose to enter now by the side door or the back door or the cellar door. The Senate has so declared. The executive has so declared. The people themselves have so declared. Nothing could be stamped more decisively with finality.
Thus did President Warren G. Harding reaffirm his position in regard to the proposed entry of the U.S. into the League of Nations, yet retaining his advocacy of participation by the U.S. in the World Court. Critics of the Permanent Court of International Relations at The Hague declared that confirmation of the president's wishes would, 1,
lead toward entry into the League of Nations,
2,
lead into dangerous foreign entanglements,
3,
tend toward a split in the Republican Party.
The U.S. entered neither the League of Nations nor the World Court. And although President Harding's mind was weighted down by problems of international importance, the enigmatic puzzles of imminent odious scandals within his own administration pressed him even harder. Within a few months, two appointive officials in two different departments committed suicide. Another was asked by Harding to take a trip to Europe, and while there to resign. So it was with the thought of throwing off these burdens of the highest office in the land, Warren Gamaliel Harding took leave of the White House and left Washington June 20, accompanied by Mrs. Harding, Secretary of the Interior Hubert Work, his personal physician, Charles E. Sawyer, George Christian, Secretary to the President, a few personal friends, secretaries, newsmen, Secret Service operatives, and a Navy band. Everywhere the President was called upon to perform that service he most loved, speak to his constituents. Returning from Alaska, the party arrived at Seattle. The President spoke again under a blazing sun in the open-air stadium. That night, Dr. Sawyer was hurriedly called to the President's room. Harding had suffered a painful attack. Despite his illness, however, he insisted that he and his party continue on to San Francisco. Arriving in the Bay City on July 29, he went immediately to bed. For 5 days, he remained in his room at the Palace Hotel, an anxious nation reading the hourly bulletins of information concerning the chief's condition. Then,
August 3, 1923, at about 2 o'clock in the morning, in a rambling New England farmhouse near Plymouth, Vermont...
Calvin! Calvin! Calvin, wake up, son!
Yes? What is it, Father? Come in.
Calvin, President Harding is dead.
Very well. Grace and I will dress right away.
Then a short time later, surrounded by a few newspaper men, his secretary, his chauffeur, and his wife, Calvin Coolidge faces his father. The father who had held such high hopes for the eventual eminence of his taciturn son. John Coolidge, a notary public, holds in one hand the old family Bible, in the other, a copy of the Constitution.
All right, son. Raise your hand. I do solemnly swear...
I do solemnly swear...
that I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability...
And will, to the best of my ability...
preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Thus, by the flickering light of two kerosene lamps in the living room of the house in which he had been born, did Calvin Coolidge become the 30th President of the United States.
1923, that was the year... 7 destroyers, Delphi, S.P. Lee, Consey, Woodbury, Young, Fuller, Nicholas, ran aground about 9 p.m. September 8, 2 miles north of Point Arguello. Reports indicate 10 lives lost, names unknown. All personnel not required for salvage work and 10 bodies are being sent tonight by special train to San Diego. The commander destroyer Squadron 11 has been instructed to report names of dead and injured to Navy Department. F.S. Robeson, Admiral, USN.
This was the official report of the catastrophe in which 25 men went to their deaths off the Pacific coast in one of the heaviest fogs in Southern California history.
1923, that was the year.
That Tom Gibbons stayed the limit of 15 rounds with heavyweight champion Jack Dempsey at Selby, Montana, before a handful of about 16,000 spectators. Inasmuch as the event went $116,000 into the red, might it not be fitting to dedicate this contemporary song hit to the promoters of that sporting bust?
Ooh, sorry not, ooh, sorry not, whose heart is aching for breaking its bond, who's sad and blue, who's crying too, just like I cried over you. Just like a friend, I tried to warn you somehow, but always you had your way. Now you must pay. I'm glad that you're sorry now.
Sorry now. Who's sorry now? Whose heart is aching for breaking its bond? Who's sad and blue? Who's crying too?
For it's just the way I cry over you.
Your way,
now you must pay. I'm glad that you're sorry now.